As you write your life story, you're far from finished. Are you looking to close the book on your job? Maybe turn a page in your career? Be continued at the Georgetown University School of Continuing Studies. Our professional master's degrees and certificates are designed to meet you where you are and take you where you want to go. At Georgetown SCS, the learning never stops, and neither do you. Write your next chapter. Be continued at scs.georgetown.edu/podcast.
Hey, it's Wendy.
And it's Jess, and you're listening to the Food Heaven Podcast,
your online resource for delicious and nutritious living.
This podcast episode is sponsored by B&W Quality Growers, the world's largest grower and marketer of watercress.
Well, Jess, what exactly is watercress?
Great question. Watercress is a leafy green packed with flavor and nutrition. It's one of the most nutrient-dense vegetables in the world and has a pleasantly spicy flavor that I personally love. And I have another fun fact for you. Did you know that consuming one serving of watercress will provide you with more than 18 essential vitamins and minerals, including iron and vitamins A, C, and K?
Our favorite way to enjoy watercress is in salads, on top of soups, or on pizza. In the coming months, we'll be developing really delicious watercress recipes. We can't wait to share those with you. But in the meantime, go to watercress.com to learn more about why watercress is one of our favorite leafy greens. On to today's episode.
Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of the Food Heaven Podcast with Wendy and Jess. Today, we're talking all about prenatal nutrition with Lily Nichols. Lily is a registered dietitian, certified diabetes educator, researcher, and author with a passion for evidence-based prenatal nutrition and exercise. Her best-selling book, Real Food for Gestational Diabetes, presents a revolutionary, nutrient-dense, lower-carb diet for managing gestational diabetes. Her unique approach has not only helped tens of thousands of women manage their gestational diabetes, mostly without the need for blood sugar-lowering medication, but it has also influenced nutrition policies internationally. Lily's second book, Real Food for Pregnancy, outlines the exact problems with current prenatal nutrition guidelines and provides the evidence that supports a real food diet to optimize maternal and fetal health. Lily is also the creator of the popular blog PilatesNutritionist.com, which explores a variety of topics related to food, mindful eating, and pregnancy nutrition. Welcome to the podcast, Lily.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, so we're so excited to have you on the podcast again. And for those of you who aren't aware, we actually interviewed Lily previously for another episode where we talked all about the management of gestational diabetes. So we'll include the link to that show in the show notes. So just for those who didn't tune in last time, kind of give us an idea of how you got into prenatal nutrition and what makes you so passionate about women and pregnancy. And then also kind of what prompted you to write your new book, Real Food for Pregnancy.
You know, I've specialized in prenatal nutrition for most of my career as an RD. I was first interested in the topic actually from a very young age. You know, I decided I wanted to be a dietitian when I was in high school or study nutrition. I didn't know all the ins and outs of nutritionist versus dietitian back then, but I knew I wanted to study nutrition. And it was in before and then in my training, you know, that was right around the time that childhood obesity and diabetes was becoming such a big problem. I was hoping that maybe I could switch the, you know, school nutrition guidelines or something to help tackle that. And it wasn't until I was working in the public policy sphere with the California Diabetes and Pregnancy Program, also known as Sweet Success, that I started to learn about this link between gestational diabetes and childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes. So children born to moms of poorly controlled blood sugar have a sixfold higher risk of being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes or being obese by the time they're 13. And it was like, whoa, this is one of those two birds with one stone moment, you know, help moms have a healthier pregnancy. And maybe we will shift the epigenetics in these kids, like shift the way that their genes are expressed, so they're less predisposed to these metabolic issues later in life. It like really lit a fire under me for sure. Of course, led to the writing of the first book. And after releasing The Real Food for GD, you know, it really took on a life of its own. I didn't imagine it would become as popular as it has become. I didn't imagine it would have an influence on, you know, international prenatal nutrition guidelines or anything like that. But the outcomes were so positive that I started getting asked from other clinicians, hey, do you have any recommendations on a book for prenatal nutrition? Because I think what's in Real Food for GD makes a lot of sense for all pregnant moms. I'm currently giving out your book to my clients with this caveat that you don't have gestational diabetes, but eat this way anyways. And then can you recommend something? So I started scouring the market, you know, seeing what I could find. And I was really disappointed by the quality of the books that I came across, and decided that finally, okay, yes, I will tackle this project. So here we are.
Yes. And I actually have Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. Love it. And also got a chance to read your new book, which I think is fantastic as well. And so in the new book, you kind of talk about your definition of real food, which has three components. So can you share how you specifically define real food?
Sure thing. Yeah, real food is sort of an ambiguous term. There's a lot of semantics around it, depending on what people's beliefs are about food. So I see real food thrown around a lot with sometimes it doesn't exactly fit in with my definition of it. So thank you for that prompt. And by my definition, real food is as close to the way that it was grown or raised as possible. And so meaning unprocessed, and also grown in a way that hopefully maximizes its nutrient density. So for example, we have some pretty good data on the way that animals are fed and the levels of nutrients in the meat or the eggs or the dairy from those animals. So grass-fed, pasture-raised animals tend to have a better balance of fats, like more omega-3 fats, less omega-6, higher concentrations of certain vitamins, like vitamins A and E. So definitely takes into consideration quality. Another thing is that it is minimally processed. So think about everything we're told about dairy products, for example. Dairy naturally comes with fat. And it naturally comes with fat probably for a reason, because there's nutrients in there as well. But our low-fat guidelines tend to push people towards low-fat or non-fat dairy products. From my perspective on real food, I think we should be eating it, again, as close to its source as possible. And that means in terms of processing, not processing things to remove the fat that it naturally contains. Like powdered peanut butter, for example. I just saw that recently. I mean, I've seen it before, but it was like in my face at the grocery store. And I was like, why would anybody want to eat defatted peanut powder instead of just peanut butter?
Right.
So that's another part of it. And then, you know, it doesn't have additives or other, you know, chemical ingredients that are added to it. So if a product A doesn't have an ingredient list, like it's fresh produce or meat or eggs, fantastic. Or if it is a packaged product, just my definition of real food is that it has as little additives as possible. Obviously, like salt and spices and stuff like that is fine. But when you start to get to those really impronounceable chemical additives, you go down this slippery slope, because some of them are not so good. I take like a guilty until proven innocent approach to most food additives.
Interesting. So one other thing that you talk about in the book, which you kind of mentioned already, is kind of the epidemic of childhood diabetes. And I know just from working in pediatrics in a clinic, I've seen a lot of kids who have pre-diabetes, or even some kids who have, you know, diabetes, type 2 diabetes. And so you mentioned in the book that some of this may be due to inadequate nutrition and metabolic problems that they may have been exposed to while mom was pregnant. So can you kind of elaborate on like the link that you found between those two things in your research?
Yeah, one of the biggest predisposing factors to that is A, maternal diet, and B, maternal blood sugar levels, which also ties in back to the diet. So when a mother's blood sugar is elevated, when you get to a certain point in pregnancy, you know, our body regulates our blood sugar with insulin. and a mother's insulin does not cross the placenta. So if a mother is not able to have normal blood sugar control, her baby is also exposed to that high blood sugar. And once they're at a certain point in development where their pancreas is able to produce insulin, their pancreas gets kind of overworked in utero, trying to control for the high blood sugar that they're being exposed to. And what we're now seeing is that, you know, cord blood levels of insulin, meaning a baby's insulin levels, actually correlate with childhood obesity later on. We're also seeing a mother's nutrient intake, specifically carbohydrates and mostly refined carbohydrates and sugars in high levels, also correlates with a baby's body fat percentage at birth and also their later on risk for remaining with a high percentage of body fat or being overweight or obese later on. There's some other like little niggly ones that are interesting. Like there's a link between artificial sweetener consumption in pregnancy that seems to correlate with obesity as well, even when controlling for a bunch of other different factors. And then one more I'll throw out. There's a lot. One more I'll throw out is the microbiome, which is, you know, the levels of beneficial bacteria that we have in our body. So they have been able to link an imbalance in a mother's intestinal bacteria to a higher risk for weight problems in children later in life as well, which points to a couple of things, but that we need to take the microbiome seriously and like feed your body good foods that contain probiotics, the good bacteria, and prebiotics, the fibers and other foods that help feed these bacteria. And also, if possible, keep antibiotic use minimal or non-existent if possible during pregnancy and delivery, so these babies can actually receive that good bacteria. The bacteria in our body have a huge role in our metabolism, and it's just wild, but it's mostly passed on from generation to generation, specifically from a mother during pregnancy and particularly during birth. So these are just a handful of examples, but there's a lot that goes into it, actually. It's not just a fate or destiny thing. And it's not just these kids are not eating good food and are not moving enough. That's certainly part of it. But there is this predisposition that can be set up by in utero factors.
Right. Yeah. And so you kind of mentioned that, you know, when people were asking you about good resources when it came to prenatal nutrition, you couldn't find any like books or anything that you thought were quality that you really wanted to recommend to folks. So what are kind of like one or two things that conventional nutrition gets wrong when it comes to nutrition during pregnancy?
Very good question, because there's many of those covered in the book. One of the big ones, I think, is sort of an imbalance in the macronutrient recommendations. Conventional guidelines push a fairly high carb, low fat diet. And this might be like five reasons all bundled up into one. So we'll try to keep it brief. But essentially, they recommend a diet that has like 45 to 65% of calories coming from carbs. So like half carbs and pretty low fat. And by default, when you end up following these guidelines, you actually end up displacing a lot of nutrient dense foods simply because of their fat content is too high, again, according to the guidelines. And then prioritizing more, you know, grain-based type foods. And when you actually look at micronutrient intake in pregnant women, women who are eating on the lower end of carbs and more low glycemic carbs tend to have higher micronutrient intake than those that are eating higher carbs, which makes sense because for the most part, most people, when they eat more carbs, are eating in the form of processed, refined carbs, which don't have a lot of nutrients, with the exception of the ones that have been fortified. That is definitely an issue. I think especially the high carbohydrate intake is an issue. I mean, if you do the math, the 45 to 65% of carbs, that calculates out to, if we assume a woman needs like 2,200 to 2,600 calories a day, in the latter half of pregnancy, that's a minimum of 250 grams of carbs a day, which is by all definitions a high carbohydrate diet. If you eat the 65%, that's like over 400 grams. It's just a lot of carbohydrates. And you know, we have this epidemic of gestational diabetes going on. Upwards of 18% of people's pregnancies are complicated by that. Plus, we have a whole slew of people that have undiagnosed type 2 or prediabetes. Like the latest stats from the Journal of the American Medical Association was upwards of 52% of adults.
Oh my God.
So we have a lot of women coming into pregnancy with blood sugar issues of varying severities, most of which have no idea that it's going on. And we are also seeing that, especially in early pregnancy, these early pregnancy blood sugars, even if they're only slightly elevated, meaning below the diagnostic criteria for gestational diabetes, there's research showing a higher risk of congenital heart defects and also neural tube defects. And those happen in the first 8 weeks of pregnancy. So I don't think it makes sense for us to, across the board at least, be recommending a high carbohydrate diet when we know half of people have some level of blood sugar insulin regulation issues going on, and that high blood sugar, even if it's just mildly elevated, could have serious consequences on pregnancy outcomes. So I just don't think it makes sense to recommend that. Another thing that I take issue with, well, I'll just stick to the macronutrients because it's on the top of my head, is the protein recommendations. So the protein recommendations are actually kind of low for pregnancy. It's like 0.88 grams per kilos, which is about 60 grams of protein per day for a 150 pound woman. What's interesting is if you dig into the Institute of Medicine guidelines on like how these levels were set, it actually only takes into account one single protein requirement study of pregnant women. All the other data it relies on are from non-pregnant adults. And there was a recent, very well-designed study that was the first ever to estimate protein requirements during different stages of pregnancy. And by the way, this was done like relatively recently. This was done in 2015. So it's crazy like how behind some of this data is. You're like, what? The first study to measure actual protein needs? Anyways, they found that in early pregnancy, which they defined as less than 20 weeks, protein needs were 39% higher than this recommendation. And in late pregnancy, these needs are actually 73% higher compared to current estimated average requirements.
Wow.
So even, again, it's just this, the ratios of things are really thrown off. And if you are trying to follow the guidelines to meet your carbohydrate needs, to not exceed your fat needs, to only eat lean meat, to only eat low-fat dairy, by default, you might not be getting enough protein as well. So this is just something that, again, these are two examples from, I don't know, probably dozens. I haven't tallied up all of the issues that I tackle in the book, but these are two very, you know, solid examples of reasons that we need to be a little more careful maybe with how seriously we take the guidelines and be open to what new research finds, because sometimes it is very different than what's in the guidelines.
Right. You actually answered my next two questions, because I was going to ask you about, yeah, this is perfect. I was going to ask you about carbohydrates and kind of with your research, how the needs kind of differ, and then also protein. So it sounds like carbohydrate needs are kind of questionable with the conventional approach, like the amount that's being recommended, especially for women during pregnancy, and protein needs are much higher than the conventional recommendation. So those are kind of like your macronutrients. So if we're going to go kind of into the micronutrients, what are things that you found are most commonly lacking in a prenatal diet? And how can women make sure that they're getting enough of these micronutrients?
Oh gosh, there are so many. I have a whole section on the book going through nutrient-dense foods that have said nutrients that are commonly lacking. It honestly depends in terms of like, is there a perfect study that tells you all the things that are commonly lacking? There's not one study because it's really hard to measure all of those things in all of these different populations all at once. But we have a lot of, if you look at multiple studies, like a whole body of evidence, we see a lot of nutrients, some of which are fairly new to the scene, like choline, for example. Like the first recommended intake for choline was set in 1998. That's only 20 years ago. And we know that 94% of women do not meet the current choline requirement. And now we're seeing that the current choline requirement probably isn't even high enough to meet the needs of pregnancy, because when they supplement women with double the amount, you have better outcomes. You have lower rates of preeclampsia, and you also have better infant brain development. So it's hard for me to answer that question on like a point blank way, but I would say definitely choline. Vitamin B12 is also very commonly lacking. Zinc and iron. These are two minerals that are especially well absorbed from animal proteins specifically. They're found in plant foods as well, but the absorption is significantly lower. Those are often lower as well, and deficiencies in both of those can be linked to preterm birth and some other pregnancy complications. I would also add to this omega-3s like DHA, which is a very important omega-3 for brain development, and also tends to have some anti-inflammatory properties. So it's been shown to play a role in blood sugar and blood pressure regulation. Like women who have preeclampsia or gestational diabetes tend to have lower intakes and lower levels of those specific fats. Those are pretty commonly lacking. And part of that is due to just dietary preferences in general. And part of that is due to the guidelines as well, because our main sources of omega-3 fats, at least the DHA form, is seafood. And if you follow the guidelines to keep your seafood at or below 12 ounces per week, then it's going to be a lot harder to meet your omega-3 needs. Plus, a lot of women are further pushed away from doing fish because they hear information about mercury and then are afraid to eat any. So there's a lot of women who just like steer clear of it entirely due to just getting incomplete information about these foods.
Right. Yeah. And I know, you know, just with my counseling with people, the focus really is just on variety, which it sounds like, you know, in your book as well, just making sure that we're not kind of sticking to the same foods every day, because then it's really easy to be missing a lot of these important nutrients that, you know, we're not getting from not having a lot of variety. Now, Wendy and I are kind of anti-food labels when it comes to like eating styles, but we are, you know, both kind of pro-plant eating within the context of a flexible eating plan. And I know in your book, you mentioned one of the challenges of someone following a strict vegan diet, which is not us, but somebody following a strict vegan diet that doesn't involve eggs, is that it misses out on some important nutritional qualities in the yolk. You already talked kind of about choline. So in your opinion, is there a way to be predominantly plant-based and still have a healthful pregnancy? And what would that look like for a pregnant mom?
Yeah, I can endorse a vegetarian diet that has some very, very careful planning and supplementation. I can't fully endorse a vegan diet. I don't think it's, honestly, from the research I've read, this will sound like a strong statement, but I think it would be unethical for me to endorse a vegan diet during pregnancy. If you go through all the foods that are the most nutrient dense sources of some of these nutrients we just talked about that are commonly lacking in a diet, they actually are from animal foods. So if you like reverse engineer the optimal prenatal diet, it does include some animal foods. That doesn't mean it doesn't also include plants. If you look at the sample meal plan in my book, there's loads and loads of vegetables and stuff in there. So that definitely has plant foods. But we also have to consider, where are you going to get some of these other nutrients? So some of the nutrients that can be tricky to get on a vegetarian diet include vitamin B12, choline, glycine, which is a special amino acid that's completely not discussed at all in conventional guidelines. I didn't even really read that much about this nutrient until after all of my training as a dietitian, which is kind of shocking. But glycine is conditionally essential during pregnancy, meaning you need to get it from your diet to get enough for yourself and also for your baby. And it plays a very important role in the skeletal system, connective tissue, so like bone, skin, joints, all of that. And that is predominantly found in the bone, skins, and joints of animal foods. Another nutrient that can be lacking is preformed vitamin A or retinol. A lot of people lack the ability to convert plant like beta carotenes or alpha carotenes into retinol in sufficient quantities. Vitamin K2, DHA, iron, and zinc. So those are the ones that you just really need to have on your radar if you choose to go plant-based. And certainly if you do, some of the things that I recommend doing would be A, definitely including eggs in your diet. That's going to be an excellent source of the choline, which would be very, very challenging to meet without it. And also gives you, you know, B12, vitamin A, DHA, especially if you're doing like pasture-raised eggs. There's a bunch of other recommendations. So let me know if you want me to go into all of them or if you have a follow-up question before I dive in.
No, I think that that's kind of a good kind of place to start. And I think folks who are, you know, following a strictly plant-based diet and who are pregnant, I would recommend grabbing a copy of the book, just so that, as Lily mentioned, like there are some nutrients of concern. So you can see like kind of what you might want to consider supplementing with if you definitely, you know, are not going to incorporate any animal foods into your diet. You talk a lot in your book about the synergistic properties of food, and I love this. So for people who aren't dietitians, can you talk about like what that is and why it is so important?
Yeah, sure. So I love this topic too, because I feel like nutrition science has kind of been this reductionist field for a long time, where we're just looking at a specific nutrient in isolation and how that works, or how deficiency in this specific nutrient in isolation affects a person, and then supplementing with that nutrient in isolation undoes the deficiency symptoms or whatnot. But when you look at food as a whole, food comes with lots of different nutrients in specific combinations, and we're just starting to see how some of this kind of plays a role. Like choline, for example, helps to enhance the incorporation of DHA into your cells. And where do you find choline? Where you usually find choline right along DHA in foods, right? But if you're taking a, you know, isolated choline supplement, it probably doesn't come with the DHA, and then vice versa, right? So I think there's a lot of wisdom in food itself. There's also wisdom even in the ways that people traditionally combine foods. So for example, with vegetables, there's a lot of different antioxidants in vegetables. Some of them are fat soluble, meaning they're best absorbed with fat. And so when you look at studies where people have a salad with low fat salad dressing or no salad dressing versus one that incorporates salad dressing or another good source of fat, such as avocado, you actually have higher absorption of these beneficial antioxidants and nutrients like beta carotene. So there's just, I just think there's so much we can learn from a food itself, eating in its whole form, and also from the way that cultures would traditionally consume their foods, what parts of the foods they might eat, you know. So if we go back to the animal thing, you know, traditional cultures didn't only eat boneless, skinless chicken breast and then throw out every other part of the chicken. They were eating it with the skin on. They were cooking it bone in. Such a pain to like do that, to remove the bones before it's cooked. It'd be bone in, and that ups the glycine content. Skin on, that ups the glycine content. And you'd probably eat the organs, which are most concentrated in some of these nutrients that are difficult to obtain in your diet, like B12 and iron and choline and zinc. So there's wisdom in all of it, I think. And we're just starting to sort of, from the, you know, from the back end, I guess, put the puzzle pieces back together and see why it makes so much sense to eat less processed foods, and how fortified foods don't necessarily take their place, because you might not be getting the nutrients in the right form or the right quantity or the right synergy, because we just don't know.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And kind of along those same lines. So then obviously whole foods are best, but do you recommend that women take a prenatal vitamin during pregnancy? Because I get this question. Well, I got it more when I was working in a prenatal clinic, but do you recommend women take that vitamin?
You know, in most cases, yes, I do. And that's because when you actually like run somebody's food intake through a nutrient analysis software, like Chronometer is a great one that you can do for free, by the way.
Love Chronometer.
I don't know why, like, well, MyFitnessPal, please like put in micronutrients. Everybody gets so obsessed by macros, and you get all bogged down by all these numbers that are make you into a crazy human being. Or you can use Chronometer, ignore all the calorie numbers, and look at your micronutrient levels and see where you're falling short. If you actually run that for a pregnant woman and then take into consideration the nausea and or food aversions that she may or may not have, a lot of times you do start to see holes in nutrient intake. So if you're, you know, if you're like a uber clean, good, I don't know, I don't want to use those words. If you're somebody who takes a very careful time planning what you eat and you're really taking nutrient density into consideration, I'll put it that way. So incorporating, you know, chapter 3 of the book is all about these foods to emphasize. If that's you and you don't happen to have food aversions or other things, you probably can get by without a prenatal vitamin. And it's probably no big deal. However, if you're not a person who likes to eat seafood regularly, if you don't like eggs, if you're averse to vegetables and meat right now, if you're all these examples, maybe a prenatal vitamin makes sense. So most of the time I do recommend them. I just make sure that people know that it's not a replacement for real food for all the reasons, all the synergy reasons that we talked about, but also because nutrient requirements during pregnancy are not necessarily etched in stone. I gave the choline example already, but vitamin B12, we're showing that what's actually required in pregnancy is triple what the current RDA is. So if you're getting a prenatal that has 100% of your RDA and you eat 100% plant-based diet and you think like, well, I'm covered. Well, you're not getting any B12 from your food if you're fully vegan. And this supplement actually only covers a third of your needs. You actually need more than that. We just need to really be smart about how we're supplementing and how much we rely on the prenatal vitamin to meet our needs. I also have like a number of things to look at on a label, like the types of B vitamins that might be included. So you can be choosing a prenatal that has optimal amounts and optimal forms of the vitamin that are best absorbed or most like metabolically active, like the activated B vitamins, for example. I also think a prenatal does not necessarily take the place of other supplementation, again, if needed. So if you're somebody who doesn't get a lot of sun exposure or is prone to vitamin D deficiency, you're probably not going to get enough vitamin D just from your prenatal vitamin, because they tend to not want to include a ton because they want to keep the number of capsules down a lot. If you're someone who doesn't eat seafood several times a week, you're probably going to want to consider where you can get your DHA in supplemental form. These are just two examples, but again, it's like an insurance policy, not a replacement for food is really my motto.
Absolutely. And just like back to the Chronometer. So even for people who aren't pregnant or aren't expecting, you can still use that website. I'll just do kind of like with my patients who I feel like are not meeting their needs, like even not meeting their calorie needs. I'll plug things in for them. And so we can go through every single micronutrient and show, okay, like you're not getting any vitamin D, you're not getting any of your omega-3s, you're not getting any of these, and to really help to push people to have more variety within what they're eating and also, yeah, just to eat more.
Yeah, there's a whole, it's a big problem. A lot of people are under eating. It's kind of crazy. Another thing on Chronometer that I think is really cool is it calculates your omega-6 and omega-3s. This is actually pretty important in pregnancy because they're showing that a lot of women have to eat too many omega-6 fats, which primarily are from vegetable oils, and not enough omega-3s. And if the balance is too far off, having too many omega-6s can be kind of inflammatory. It's linked to higher chances of preeclampsia, for example. It can interfere with nutrient transport across the placenta and also can interfere with the incorporation of omega-3s where they need to go, like into your baby's brain, for example, for like really good brain development. So I love that about Chronometer because you can put in people's food intake. And if you see that ratio is pretty far off, you know, in an ideal world, it'd be anywhere from like 1:1 to 4:1. And most people are like 10:1 or sometimes as much as 30:1. You can start to be like, okay, we're seeing this fried food or something that's coming in from like a restaurant meal that's giving you, you know, a lot of these omega-6 fats, maybe we can replace that with something else. Or maybe we can change out your cooking oil for a healthier cooking oil, which ironically is very different than what the conventional guidelines are. But too many of these, vegetable oils and plant-based unsaturated fats really ups the omega-6 ratio. And you see that very clearly in Chronometer.
Yeah, I agree too. Now, okay, just taking a little bit of a turn. In your book, you mention that when you ignore your hunger cues, you tend to ignore your fullness cues as well. And so how do you incorporate intuitive eating, which me and Wendy are both big advocates in some ways with intuitive eating? How do you incorporate that into your pregnancy nutrition talks?
Oh, yeah. Gosh, I think mindfulness is central to like everything. I'm a huge proponent of mindfulness. And I think it comes in many more ways in pregnancy than probably ever in your life, because there's this odd, you have to just be so in tune. Even like, for example, if there's an issue with your baby, like one of the most reliable ways to know if a baby is in distress is a mother's fetal kick counts. That's like just you paying attention to your body. And that's actually like very, in the research, it's like a very strong correlate with a baby's well-being. And that's all about mom just paying attention. So when it comes to the food stuff, mindful eating is very helpful in, again, learning what quantities of food make you feel good, but also learning about what kinds of food make you feel good. So for example, paying attention to how you're feeling before, during, and after a meal in terms of your energy levels, your hunger levels, how your stomach is feeling, how your nausea is, what kinds of cravings you have. Sometimes that'll give you very clear direction on what's going to be best for your body at that specific time, at that specific day. And it might change from day to day, but you're able to respond to those and like develop a sense of trust in your body. And it sounds like kind of woo to people sometimes, because especially as dietitians, we're so number oriented and data driven, but they've actually shown in research that mindful eating during pregnancy leads women to eat a more nutritious diet overall and consume less junk food. There's also a lot of research done outside of pregnancy that look at mindfulness and like weight control, for example, because they've used it in some studies to see if mindful eating could really work as opposed to like a super calorie controlled or macronutrient controlled diet. And for the most part, it seems to work well and sometimes works better than the restrictive diet. Your body will send you cues when you've eaten the wrong thing or eaten too much of something or eaten too frequently or, you know, fill in the blank. Your body sends you cues. And it's a matter of paying attention to that and responding to that and trusting that your body probably has a reason in giving you that cue of heartburn or upset stomach or super full that you can barely stand up and walk or, you know, whatever the signal is at that time.
I could not agree more with you. And I just want to thank you so much for being a part of our podcast again. We loved having you on the first time. We're always referencing that podcast. And I know that I learned a ton from this conversation, and I know that our listeners have as well. So just for people who are interested, how can our audience buy your book? Where is it going to be in stores?
Yeah, the book will be available for now exclusively on Amazon in print and in Kindle, and I may record an audiobook at some point. You can go over to realfoodforpregnancy.com. Over there, I'm going to be, A, I link out to where you can buy the book, but B, I'm also giving away the first chapter for free for anyone who's kind of interested but not interested enough to actually buy it yet. Then head on over there and you can read the first chapter and get a taste for it. I think one of the things that people have really enjoyed about reading the first chapter is that I include a nutrient comparison on like the conventional sample meal plan compared to a real food meal plan. And you can see the nutrient breakdown. So that's been a big one that I think especially dietitians have enjoyed, again, because we're so data driven, mm-hmm. that it's helpful to see what it looks like and in real food, real world, real nutrient terms. So right. Yeah, excited for it to get out into the world.
Yay, excited for you. And where can folks find you online as well? So you mentioned your book website, but can you share your website too?
Yeah, my main website is PilatesNutritionist.com. And you can find me on Twitter, Facebook, and I'm kind of new to Instagram. I think you guys actually encouraged me to get on Instagram finally. So
yeah, Wendy did say that.
Yeah, I pulled the plug. I'm on Instagram. For better or for worse. But over on Facebook, it's Pilates Nutritionist. And for both Twitter and Instagram, it's at Lily Nichols, RDN.
Thanks again for being part of our podcast, Lily.
Hey, thank you.
So with that, we're going to wrap things up.
Thank you guys so much for tuning in to another episode of the Food Heaven podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please do us a huge favor and leave us a review on iTunes right now before you forget. The more reviews we get, the higher we're ranked in iTunes, which means we reach more people. And of course, if you're not following us online, make sure to connect on Instagram. Our handle is at Food Heaven Show. Facebook, we're at Food Heaven Made Easy, and Twitter, we're at Food Heaven Show as well. Now, for those of you guys who are just tuning in, remember that our podcast is released every Wednesday, and in each episode, we cover tips and tricks for making lifelong, sustainable, healthy living changes to upgrade your diet and your health. We also interview leading experts in the field of health and nutrition to pick their brains on how to cultivate a healthy and happy life that you love. So we hope you guys enjoy this episode, and we'll catch you next time. Bye.
Bye.